Hey, this is Cedric Youngelman, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. In this rip with Smeet Bhatt, the CEO and co-founder of Thea, we discuss counterparty risk, Bitcoin accelerationism, and simplifying Bitcoin multi-sig. But before we get into all that, I want to give a quick shout out to our amazing sponsors. These Bitcoin-focused companies are the ones that I use myself and recommend to my friends and family. River is the best place to stack sats and build your Bitcoin wealth. Buy Bitcoin at the tightest spreads in the industry. Have peace of mind thanks to River's 100% full reserve cold storage custody, and enjoy zero fees on recurring orders. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. Go to partner.river.com/matrix to get started and earn up to $100 in Bitcoin when you buy Bitcoin on River. Thea is an app for simplified Bitcoin self-custody. With its 2 of 3 multi-sig custody solution, you can enjoy maximum security for your Bitcoin and the peace of mind that comes with it. Download Thea now at thea.us/Cedric. That's thea.us/CEDRIC. And get your first 6 months free and get on the new standard in Bitcoin multi-sig security. If you need help securing your Bitcoin, getting your estate planning and or asset protection strategies in order so that you know your Bitcoin will be there for your loved ones if anything happens to you, put some time on my calendar at thebitcoinadvisor.com/Cedric. That's thebitcoinadvisor.com/CEDRIC. Set up some time now before Bitcoin goes parabolic again and you can't sleep at night because of your security or lack thereof. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Smeet Bhatt for this fantastic rip on how energy is prosperity, Bitcoin accelerationism, and the demystification of self-custody.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Smeet Bhatt is a design-driven technologist and a performance analyzer. Smeet is the co-founder and CEO of Thea, a Y Combinator-backed Bitcoin startup. Thea is an app for simplified Bitcoin self-custody. With its 2 of 3 multi-sig custody solution, you can enjoy maximum security for your Bitcoin and the peace of mind that comes with it. Smeet Bhatt, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Thank you. Thanks, Cedric, for having me on the show. I've been a long time listener of your show and have learned a lot. So kind of excited about this conversation.
Yeah, I'm super excited to get into it for several reasons. One, I want to thank you guys for being a sponsor. Your support means a lot to me and helps me power the show. Also, one of the reasons I'm excited to partner with you guys is because of what you guys are doing. I'm now with the Bitcoin Advisor. Our goal and mission is to get people's Bitcoin and sats off of exchange. Whether they use our services or your services, or anybody's services, that's really our number one goal. But I've gotten to learn about Thea a lot, and I'm using Thea at home. And so I really want to kind of get into it. But first, I'd like to hear more about you and maybe what you were up to before Bitcoin. Maybe what'd you study or how'd you kind of get your career started?
Yeah, absolutely. So I did my undergraduate in physics and engineering, specifically civil engineering. So spent 4 years doing, theoretical physics, a little bit of computer science as well. But for the most part, spent time on physics and civil engineering. I've not really spent any professional time in either civil engineering or physics, but it was really, physics and engineering in general has been something that I've sort of carried all along across my career and has helped me think about various problems in a very, very different light. Right out of college, got a job on Wall Street with, a firm called Deutsche Bank. I was doing, counterparty risk trading with Deutsche Bank's, FX and rates team. What I mean by that is essentially our counterparties would end up being hedge funds and large sort of institutional investors who would be taking positions in FX and interest rate derivatives against Deutsche Bank, and we would technically be having a lot of like counterparty risk in terms of will these hedge funds and institutions, you know, pay off the bet in case Deutsche Bank ends up winning the trade. And to that extent, you know, any financial institution, any large investment bank, especially in the post 2008 era, had to like do a lot of like counterparty risk hedging, and that's how I kind of started my career. Obviously, that was my first foray into finance, you know, global economics and markets, and that kind of like stuck with me. You know, counterparty risk has been something that was like very, very important concept for me to understand. It was I'm kind of glad that I got to spend quality time with some, you know, qualities of, you know, folks on Wall Street understanding that concept. And it's kind of important because counterparty risk is somewhat what brought me into Bitcoin several years later. This was in the early half of 2010s, right? So this was from 2010 to 2015 when I was with Deutsche Bank. But after spending a couple of years on Wall Street, I realized that this is not my long-term calling. I want to be building something. I want to sort of be closer to the technology industry. And to that extent, over the last, you know, decade or so, call it last 9 years, effectively, I've been an investor operator in the technology space. So Theia is technically my second startup. I had a startup before this in the virtual reality space, right when, you know, Oculus was acquired by Facebook. And I was one of the early sort of, you know, entrepreneurs in the space trying to, you know, bring about monetization and different kind of like frameworks to VR long before, you know, VR, AR, you know, Apple Vision Pro was anything of interest. After that, end up being an investor in early stage, you know, startup companies with a lot very large international investor called IDG Ventures. You know, we invested in all sorts of like fintech, software services, and the likes. And that again like gave me a very high level perspective of what it means to like, you know, run a business, operate a business, and evaluate a business at a high level. But having spent a couple of years doing investing, I again realized that this is not my calling, especially in my, you know, as I'm also still early in my career, still younger in my career. I wanted to like build things, and I wanted to like do more real on ground stuff, and end up like doing, you know, being an early operator at another enterprise software company before founding Theia in 2022. Now, you might think that, okay, like this guy has been doing mostly tech stuff, which has not really been related to Bitcoin. How did arrive to Bitcoin? And I think that story again like ties back to my days at Deutsche Bank. So even after I launched, you know, even after I left Deutsche Bank, I'd been like very, very close to the ideas of, you know, just, you know, global macro finance, economics, geopolitics. I've been a very keen observer and a student of history. You know, things happening in the global macro world has always kind of fascinated me. So even as a tech entrepreneur, as a tech investor, I've always had this sort of, you know, global macro overlay. That kind of like, you know, helped me go deeper into the Bitcoin rabbit hole, call it in like 2018, 2019 timeframe. So right after the 2017 sort of, you know, the crash, 2018, 2019 is the time when I started learning some concepts that helped me like gradually migrate to Bitcoin. And right around the COVID sort of, you know, pandemic response from the government, both on the monetary policy front as well as fiscal policy front, I got into Bitcoin from a personal finances point of view, and I've obviously not you know look back since then, right? So 2020 to 2022, those 2 years, the 2 years during COVID pandemic were the years where I was still working on a tech job, but I was putting all my savings and accumulating as much Bitcoin as I could. And it hit a point in 2022 when I wanted to like work on Bitcoin full time and obviously found a technology company. And that's how we sort of, you know, come to Thea.
That's awesome. Lots to unpack there. It's amazing and sometimes confounding how there could be so many similarities. Our stories could be similar in some ways where I went from New York City to San Francisco for similar yet slightly different reasons. So I was a Big Four auditor in New York, working on Wall Street and downtown and Midtown, big companies in New York, New York culture. And I transferred with that Big Four company out to San Francisco. And out in San Francisco, same company, audit, Big Four auditor, but now much different client base, technology, communications, energy out on the West Coast, very different cultures, East Coast, very old fashioned, very old, stodgy. Just tell me what I need to get done so I can go home by 5 o'clock and get out of here. San Francisco very much. Let's stay here all night until we could figure this out. You know, I have stock options and this company's just done wonders for me and my family, and how can I help? And, I want to talk a little bit about maybe your experiences as a derivatives trader and counterparty risk, what you learned there. But maybe did you hear about Bitcoin back in that time period when, you know, you had all these traders around you? And it's interesting, all these pieces come together for you because they prime you in different ways, how you can kind of pull different ideas from each of these fields. But I'd love to get into sort of the global macro and the counterparty risk and the trading and what maybe people were saying about Bitcoin back then.
Yeah, so I definitely came across Bitcoin in 2013 on the Deutsche Bank trading floor. I know, as I was saying, I was part of the FX trading team. So, you know, folks back on the desk were certainly like kind of excited or had heard about Bitcoin. And, you know, back then the idea was just about, oh, how can we make more money by trading this asset? If this is to be a currency, if it's a, you know, a USD FX cross, can we sell options on this? Can we like do all sorts of like, you know, interesting hedging strategies around this? And I think there were some small, super small teams around Goldman Sachs and other large investment banks who were like toying with the idea of like, you know, starting a crypto or a Bitcoin trading desk. But that was about it. Didn't really understand the principles behind Bitcoin, didn't really appreciate the whole idea of decentralization and the libertarian thought and the history of money that, you know, went into like really sort of conceptualizing Bitcoin. And to that extent, I'm kind of like obviously, you know, sad that 2013 was the first time when I could have technically fallen into the Bitcoin rabbit hole, but I definitely did not do that. And then second time I was introduced to Bitcoin in Silicon Valley in 2016, actually, by one of my technology friends, who was kind of excited about like this new thing called Bitcoin. And he was like, you know, this is how a blockchain works and things like that. And again, that was a time when I clearly did not really sort of, you know, appreciate what he was trying to say and kind of like ignored it, only to be, you know, going back into that in 2018, 2019. So I've kind of like had a chance to like maybe go deeper into it back in 2013 while I was at Deutsche Bank, but certainly missed that boat.
Do you keep in touch with anyone from 2013, or do you remember anyone kind of taking it maybe seriously, not at a business level for an institutional bank, but hey, like, I'm going to throw $1,000 into this and see what happens? Or, you know, maybe thinking of it as more as maybe a personal collectible. I always wonder about my own pea brain and when I came across it. And I, you know, the first time I think I heard about it really on, I just thought of it as really cool tech, not something you could invest in. Second time when I heard about it, it went up a lot. I thought, wow, that's something you could invest in. But I thought about, okay, that's something esoteric you could invest in. And like baseball cards, it was only just Bitcoin then, but, you know, I still thought about it as like sort of this lucky thing, you know, if it pops, if it doesn't pop. But like, I didn't think about it as like a real currency that's going to compete with the British pound or the dollar or something I'm going to a store and buy goods with, or a store of value or anything like that. So you may early on, was there anything around that, even if it wasn't you, was anyone else that you think maybe took it and ran with it?
So definitely, I don't know anyone from the 2013 timeframe who I knew back then who was trying to buy Bitcoin and has kind of hodled through the cycle. I do know some people in, you know, now in Silicon Valley who have been holding Bitcoin since 2013 and certainly since 2015, 2016. So I've now known a few folks, I would say several folks, who kind of like were excited about this internet money libertarian sort of force that was kind of unleashed by Satoshi. And some people who have kind of held on to those coins from back in the day, but certainly nobody on Wall Street, nobody from my like Deutsche Bank circles I know who kind of even like bought Bitcoin seriously in 2013. Many more folks I think like joined the cycle in 2016, 2017, 2018. So most of my friends, I would say, kind of got into it in that time frame, and that's when I also kind of started seriously looking into it. But in hindsight, I do know several people in Silicon Valley who have kind of held on to from the 2013 sort of time frame. So it's a, yeah.
And have you noticed any differences maybe in sort of in the Wall Street circles? It's, you know, how can we trade it? How can we make money on it? Were there more people in Silicon Valley who were maybe interested in the tech behind it and maybe got into like altcoins and shitcoins for the tech? You know, there's the, you know, came for the gains. There's the came for the tech crowd. You know, I guess you were fortunate you kind of come from both sides. And so you can kind of see both angles and merge those. But What was the conversation like in Silicon Valley? Whether they held or not, you know, like what were people talking about it or how'd they react to it?
Absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head. I think both sets of people, my friends and colleagues from the Wall Street sort of culture as well as from Silicon Valley culture, most of them I would not really sort of say that they kind of understood, like, or they spend enough time trying to understand Bitcoin seriously. I think for the most part, like, Wall Street folks, even till 2023, like, let's say before the Bitcoin ETFs were launched, I have, like, public posts on LinkedIn and other sort of social channels where, some of my friends from Wall Street have ridiculed me for trying to sort of, shill Bitcoin. Imagine that. But yeah, that's I think for the most part, even Wall Street today does not really understand what Bitcoin is. Maybe you could argue that some parts of Wall Street now with BlackRock and Fidelity coming up with this sort of, great marketing around what Bitcoin could do for investment portfolios. Maybe that's a little bit changing now in 2024, but all the way till 2022, 2023, most people I knew from Wall Street culture would not really take Bitcoin seriously. And at best, they would now think of it as a tradable asset that they can make money off. Silicon Valley is a little different. I think Silicon Valley was ultra bullish in the first half of 2010. So I think before the four wars, essentially, like, I think Bitcoin was a really big thing, a big phenomenon in Silicon Valley. And I know many several folks from the builder community, from the founder community, from investor community, who have basically kind of, like, toyed with Bitcoin on several different levels, right? So most of them, as you mentioned, have kind of moved on to more scalable and more efficient sort of blockchain technology movements and the whole sort of crypto crowd. So I actually don't know many folks who are, like, sort of Bitcoin only, Bitcoin maximalist kind of cultural sort of aligned folks in Silicon Valley, but there are several folks who either were, like, very excited about Bitcoin back in 2013, 2014, but because Bitcoin could not really take off as a form of medium of exchange, because, these for the most part, even technologists don't understand the history and role that money has played and the way, sort of us with more Austrian leaning understand it, right? For the most part, they think of money as a token that you use to, like, buy coffee and pizza. And we all know that Bitcoin was not really a very efficient mechanism to buy coffee or pizza in call it 2013, call it 2016, even arguably even today, it's still not, like, the best mechanism to buy coffee or pizza. And for to that extent, many of the technologists actually lost interest in Bitcoin after it had been around for 7, 8 years, 10 years, and it couldn't really do anything except for the store of value thesis. And the folks who kind of stuck around in the blockchain ecosystem, 99% of them moved on to, like, other crypto projects, and then sort of, this new fad of Web3 and NFTs and things like that. So in that sense, Silicon Valley kind of adopted Bitcoin long ago, but because Silicon Valley has a history of thinking about technologies in cycles, that, okay, like, Bitcoin was V1 tech, we need to, like, find V2 and V3 and so on and so forth, they kind of definitely missed the whole sort of Bitcoin, game theory aspect and the store of value thesis of it. And I think now there is a new realization. I see more and more non-crypto, non-Web3 investors, non-crypto founders kind of, like, realizing that, okay, like, Bitcoin is still king. Bitcoin has been around for 15 years. It is absolutely the killer asset. And I think there is now more awareness about Bitcoin being a true sort of, digital gold storehold of wealth kind of asset class that they are more favorable to. But it's funny how both Silicon Valley and Wall Street are kind of missing the market is.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely relate to how it can feel like a hall of mirrors when you come into Bitcoin, or you feel like you're maybe chasing things that don't, like butterflies or things that don't exist, dandelions. Because, I came, because of, with a finance and accounting background, trying to fight inflation, but I didn't know that's what I was doing. But I got excited about blockchain, about, the tech, and I saw that as where the value was being added. And it was just being applied to money. This was sort of what I looked at first, and I was excited for the technology. Now it could be applied to other things. And it's embarrassing to say now that I thought the technology was the blockchain. I mean, a simple, befuddled, slow database. It's kind of hilarious in a way, but I could see how you could be captured by that. especially if you haven't done a deep dive on all of these subjects, which takes a lot of
Right.
work and a lot of
Right.
humility. It's interesting. I want to go back to though 2015. So you said you started like a VR company. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So this was back in 2014. I maybe this is kind of like a lost story now, but virtual reality had like multiple waves. So like the first wave of virtual reality kind of like, believe it or not, came in like mid to late 1990s with the advent of like, silicon graphics and things like that. There was this sort of, a small niche esoteric movement around trying to like build virtual reality devices. That kind of definitely did not do, good on in terms of product iteration and really building a product for the market. Then around early parts of 2010s, there was this guy called, Palmer Luckey, who now runs a defense technology company called Anduril. He started a company called Oculus in his garage when he was 19 years old. And he built a really cool virtual reality device that could finally sort of make some sense. I mean, you could use it for 10, 15 minutes without feeling, dizzy or nauseating. And Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook basically saw this as the next computing paradigm, as the next sort of, paradigm of consumption and media. And he kind of bought it for $2 billion back in 2014. And then sort of obviously Facebook took over, and then they launched several other iterations of Oculus headsets. And I kind of all, being a techno-optimist, so to say, I always sort of thought, okay, like this is the moment where virtual reality now becomes real. So started a company, exploring like various different sort of domains within VR. But what we wanted to like do is we wanted to make sure that all the content creators back in the day who were building like virtual reality games, virtual reality content, video content, 360 content had no real way for like getting discovered by new users, and certainly did not have any mechanisms for themselves to get monetized. So what you are basically doing is you're creating a two-sided supply, a supply chain sort of marketplace where content creators can come and, get discovered for their content on various different like, app stores, and at the same time also, potentially get their games and content monetized through advertisements and things like that. So it was kind of an ad tech play in VR. And obviously by 2017, we realized that even this cycle of virtual reality is too early. The form factor does not really make sense. It's still like a very heavy device that you end up wearing on your head. It's very uncomfortable for the most people. And kind of like we raised, seed capital for that company. Okay, this is, our time is best spent somewhere else. And to that extent, we decided to, shut the company, and I decided to move on and join a venture capital firm doing, early stage startup investing.
What was that like in terms of what was your role in that process, and maybe what'd you learn?
I think doing an investing job was interesting, especially right after being kind of like burnt out by my first startup. It helped me take a step back and like sort of understand the technology space from a slightly sort of 30,000 feet level. I would say that I was in my sort of mid to late 20s when I got into that role, and it was I think I spent sufficient amount of time in that industry, which is about 2 years. I didn't want to like overdo my spend there, because what happens is once you get into this sort of this investor mind space, it really becomes hard for you to like again go back, get your roll up your sleeves and build things. And I wanted to like ultimately spend most of my time building things, doing things. But it was a good break, so to say, for after my first startup. Helped me, explore like different paradigms in technology, and especially more around like fintech and software and SaaS, where kind of my next two gigs lined up. And to that extent, I'm kind of definitely very, very happy about the time I spent there. But it's not something that I advise most young people to like end up doing, because once you're in the investing sort of, culture, I think it becomes really hard for you to like go and do a real job.
Yeah. So maybe bringing it all together, why do a startup in the Bitcoin space?
So as I said, right, all the way from 2020 to 2022, the first 2 years during after the pandemic, essentially, I became, it was I fell down the Bitcoin rabbit hole essentially in the summer of 2020. Looking at the monetary response and the fiscal response to the pandemic, I was like, this is it. This is the moment. There is no turning back. Many great people and economists and historians have seen these cycles and written about these cycles that fiat money ultimately sort of kind of, is diluted and devalued till there is nothing else left. And the way US government and especially like most other like global government central banks responded to the pandemic, I realized that okay, like we all need to like start making sense of where is the world headed and what is the role of money, and then sort of kind of like fell down the whole hard money rabbit hole. So the first 2 years from 2020 to 2022, I was still like stacking coins, and I was basically going as much as I could. And where in early out of 2022, what happened was one of my friends from 2015 timeframe who has been stacking Bitcoin, and I think his average price point was something like $400. His coins, he had unfortunately left it on BlockFi, and obviously BlockFi collapsed in the first half of 2022, and he lost a massive sum of Bitcoin with that company. And thankfully, because of my understanding of counterparty risk from Deutsche Bank days, I never really kept any material portion of my Bitcoin on exchanges somehow very early on. So I kind of like figured out that I need to figure some ways of like doing self-custody. So I've always been like doing self-custody, and I started realize that okay, like I need to do multi-sig, and then I obviously came across a couple of companies like Casa and Unchained who are sort of doing that. And then my friend who was basically, let's say, stacking Bitcoin since 2015 with an average price point of something sub $1,000, I don't exactly recall, but I think it was $400. And when I saw him lose his money with BlockFi, I'm like, okay, this is it. Like I need to really like build something that is simple, robust, secure, and easy for like most people to like custody their coins and take sovereignty and do self-custody. And so that was a real sort of turning point when I wanted to build something in Bitcoin. And especially I saw this as a big problem where people around me had suffered because of custodial failures, and I was certainly paranoid about taking custody of my own coins. And that led me to like towards thinking about how can we create this nice user experience that is not super overwhelming, that is that takes into account some sort of core design principles of how a tech product should be built, at the same time is completely like based on principles of Bitcoin. It completely has the value system of Bitcoin and does not really have any kind of counterparty risk, right? So I always wanted to, like, from day one we wanted to build a company that if it completely disappears or if we vanish overnight, our customers' coins and our customers' wealth should not disappear at all, unlike say BlockFi and FTX and Celsius and others. When they collapsed, obviously their customers lost money. In our case, we always wanted to build a company where we essentially ensure that the sovereignty is always uncompromised. And even if, let's say, for whatever reason, if we were to like disappear overnight, our customers' coins should not disappear with along with us. And that was a founding principle behind Theia. And we thought that it was for the most part, it's an unsolved problem. As I said, like there are a couple of other companies who have done a great job for the first generation of sort of Bitcoiners, but we see that Bitcoin is now going to be like ma going to have a mass adoption, and there is no mass market technology. There is no product that is built for like plebs and whole coiners with plebs and whole coiners in mind, and help them take multisig in a simple, secure, and a robust fashion. So that was the genesis of Theia in 2022.
Wow, that's incredible. That's a tough story. How far along on your Bitcoin journey in terms of maybe self-custody were you when your friend told you the story? Were you had you already taken some sats off an exchange and experimented and dealt with self-custody on your own, or were you still at the beginning of your journey?
No, I was. So I think in 2022, when the BlockFi collapse happened, I was already like more than like 95%, 98% of my coins were off exchanges. I never really traded, by the way, any I mean, Bitcoin has always been a one-way street for me. And to that extent, most of my coins were in self-custody. So I was obviously not really that concerned. But when I saw like many smart people who have been in, let's say, Bitcoin slash crypto slash blockchain world for the last 7, 8 years, losing their money with BlockFi and the likes, it really pushed me towards thinking about this being a core problem space. And the realization was that Bitcoin has been around for 15 years at this point, but custody for the most part is actually an unsolved problem. And it really sort of pains me to like see that okay, like Bitcoin has been around for 15 years. It is built on this idea of self-sovereignty and being able to control your own money, but there exists like no real sort of, user-friendly platform that both like is secure and robust, but at the same time also like, user-friendly enough for like non-technical Bitcoiners and non-technical regular people. Like they don't even have Bitcoiners, right? Like regular people to like take custody and control their own money. And so we thought that okay, this is a real problem space. Bitcoin's custody has been solved for, large institutions, and the OGs have their own way of like doing self-custody and multi-sig, but there is certainly no platform that helps the more sort of, more modest stackers of Bitcoin, let's put it that way, to take like efficient self-custody and a user-friendly multi-sig user experience. So that's how we sort of kind of got into it. And thankfully I was, in 2022, I was totally on a self-custodial standard, so it didn't really impact me. But it became very evident after like talking to a bunch of people in both in Silicon Valley and outside Silicon Valley that okay, like this is a really unsolved problem and someone needs to like do this.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to dig into there. I want to take a little bit of a detour here because I think a lot of people think about custody very from a lot of the pragmatic ways of thinking about it in terms of I don't want to counterparty risk. I want to, get my sats off an exchange. But I think a different way of looking at it is something you've written about, in October of 2023. So I want to touch on that. You put out a tweet. Bitcoin enables second renaissance. An AI variant of the previous 16th century iteration. Hardest money known to humankind, combined with AI and advances in nuclear energy and material science, empowers a hyper-productive fractal giga scaling that will transform our civilization forever. Immutable money, infinite frontier, eternal life, this is from Balaji's bio, will be asymptotically actualized. Bitcoin is inevitable. And it is in thermodynamic congruence with effective acceleration. And then you have in parentheses E over ACC, end parentheses. Both are synergistically deflationary techno-capital forces. Immutability of Bitcoin acts as the foundational monetary standard for Kardashev scaling with open-source AI and nuclear-powered acceleration. Everything there is, unit accounted by the 21 million monetary constant, no more technical capital. No more techno capital dilution. E over ACC equals Bitcoin equals B over ACC. This is fascinating. I think the reason I wanted to bring this up is because to add to the vector of why self-custody is important is if this thing gaps up dramatically, similar to what we've seen over the last 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, or last year with Bitcoin. And you think about sort of you have X amount of value of Bitcoin on the exchange now, but if that 10X is, are you going to be comfortable with it on the exchange then? You have X amount of value on your current security rig now, and you're just not confident in it. Well, how confident or less confident are you going to be in if it 10X is from now, and are you going to be able to sleep at night? But I want to get into some of this because this is, I'm not sure I fully understood all of it. So maybe we could break it down.
So I think like just sort of finishing on the loop of self-custody, I think like
And we'll get into
self-custody is
back into
important.
self-custody after this.
Absolutely. So going back to that, original post I believe was from early half of October. There is this sort of budding mimetic movement in, call it like originated in Silicon Valley, but has kind of like now spread across most of like tech and AI Twitter circles. It's called effective accelerationism. That's called EAC for short. It was a wordplay on EA, that was effective altruism. We know that folks like Sam Bankman-Fried and many others of effective altruists sort of kind of tainted that movement. EAC was in opposition to EA, and the fundamental sort of principles behind EAC, I feel, are very, very congruent to what Bitcoin stands for. And we can sort of, you know, very quickly get into that. But, you know, by and large, what EAC so stands for is that technology has been the greatest, you know, force of driving civilization forward. It believes that energy consumption is a good thing. It believes that, you know, human civilization and human progress is basically correlated to like how much energy consumption can we do per capita. So energy, you know, harnessing of free energy and, you know, using consumption of free energy is a good thing. And it basically sort of is a mimetic sort of, you know, force, or you can think of it as a movement that is built on certain ideas grounded in physics and second law of thermodynamics, and kind of these kinds of things, you know, started appealing to me. And then I saw that, okay, this thing is not just good independently, this actually has very strong alignment with the kind of principles that Bitcoin stands for. So let me like just quickly lay out three different areas where I think Bitcoin and EAC kind of has huge overlap. First and foremost, you know, EAC and Bitcoin both believe in thermodynamics and energy. I think EAC, as I said, believes that harnessing of energy for civilizational progress is must. We should not be looking to like, you know, degrow our energy consumption. We should not be looking to like, you know, regulate energy consumption and so on and so forth. And to that extent, it believes in the power of thermodynamics and the adaptation principles to take things in the right direction for evolution to happen in the right way. I think that, you know, Bitcoin's proof of work, which is basically a thermodynamic grounding, it really sort of makes Bitcoin a real thing. Bitcoin is not really just a simple ledger and a simple sort of database entry. It is really backed by you know, consumption of energy. It is backed by a thermodynamic process that can really see and observe on ground, that uses, you know, steel and silicon and ASICs and the whole Bitcoin mining infrastructure, right? So I think thermodynamics and energy is the first area where I think there is congruence between EAC and Bitcoin. The second really sort of important thing for me was decentralization and overall libertarian values in this movement, right? So while there is a small group of people who kind of wrote the first manifesto of EAC, for the most part, it's a decentralized movement. There is no central coordination of what value systems and what principles are kind of qualify as EAC. And to that extent, the fork that, you know, I have been trying to sort of go for is this BAC, which is Bitcoin Accelerationism, which is everything that sort of broadly speaking EAC believes in, but with the idea that you need hard monetary standard, you need, you know, immutable money for real acceleration to happen. And that acceleration is essentially everything in AI, in nuclear energy, in material sciences, everything that we see these days happening in several different fields. All of this can only happen effectively over long periods of time, as long as the system is not leaking monetary energy, right? So inflation needs to go away, central banks, the power of central banks and their ability to print money needs to go away. And that's the kind of decentralized nature of EAC, which allowed me to take this prominent messaging within EAC and apply Bitcoin principles onto it. You know, again, I see that as a strong, you know, a strong overlapping force. And for the most part, EAC movement has kind of like libertarian leanings, which kind of attracted to me in the first place. And the last one I would say is that it believes that technology is a force of good, and for the most part, it is a deflationary force. And this is where I think Jeff Booth's thesis comes into play, where you know, deflation is a good thing. Technology is literally a deflationary force, and more technological progress, by and large, means good for human civilization. Obviously, there needs to be certain sort of broad, you know, guardrails around it, but for the most part, we shouldn't be like regulating technological progress. We shouldn't be sort of, you know, trying to, you know, do top-down control of technological progress. And as an, you know, as we see more technology evolving, as we see like, you know, AI systems evolving, as we see more progress in nuclear energy and material science, we will see a massive deflation over the coming years and coming decades. I mean, literally, I mean, even like this week itself, and last month, and let's say just quite last year, there have been like so many exciting things happening, in the technology world. I mean, you obviously sort of know about AI and the kind of rapid progress that we are making on AI. There have been like, you know, obviously a lot of chatter around this whole idea of a material called LK99 on superconducting. It's kind of not proven that it has any properties of superconducting, but this, you know, I for the most part, I believe that we are on this cusp of a massive techno-scientific revolution. And you know, this techno-scientific revolution will only happen as long as we are able to have a monetary system that does not leak energy. And that's where Bitcoin kind of comes into play. And my claim is much stronger than that, actually. I go on claiming that Bitcoin is almost a necessary condition for acceleration. So, you know, all the technologists and accelerationists, you know, a lot of them, sort of my friends and you know, peers and colleagues in Silicon Valley, I think they don't necessarily understand, or they don't necessarily sort of value the role of hard money and immutable sort of monetary standard. And that's where Bitcoin plays a very important role, especially in defending open source as well. I think all the battles that open source AI is going to face in terms of regulatory capture and, you know, top-down control of data centers that don't allow you to host open source AI, we have kind of already seen that happening in the Bitcoin and the Bitcoin mining space. So I see a lot of like lot of areas of overlap and a lot of like interesting philosophical congruence between these two movements. And that's how I kind of like got into this idea of Bitcoin accelerationism, and it has kind of like taken on its own life in the last few weeks and few months. And we see many prominent folks on Bitcoin X, and I want to like, you know, give a shout out to Dylan, you know, and a couple of others who have been like talking about this. So yeah, it's happening. There is it's not really a centralized sort of, you know, movement that someone is trying to control or I'm trying to like push for, but I just feel that by and large, I believe that technology is a good force, and Bitcoin only accelerates technological progress and technological sort of deflation. And yeah, that's what EAC is, and that's what BEAC is. I think many people, I do want to sort of, I also like slightly clarify one point. I think Bitcoin accelerationism is primarily a lot about like accelerating technological progress and climbing this sort of Kardashev scale. It is not necessarily about accelerating Bitcoin adoption. The reason why I say this is that Bitcoin, in my opinion, does not require you know, accelerated adoption. Bitcoin will do its own thing. Bitcoin is this thing that like literally like Bitcoin doesn't care about you. You need to sort of figure out why Bitcoin is important for you. So to that extent, I want to accelerate the adoption of self-custody and multisig, but I don't think accelerating Bitcoin is something that is necessary or even possible. And to that extent, I think Bitcoin is almost an inevitability. What it will enable is this technological sort of, you know, deflationary progress and help us in this new era of like techno-scientific civilization.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you kind of unpacked it for me now, and I think I kind of get it. There's still like some really big philosophical topics here that I think we can go off on, or that just beg to be questioned, and I don't understand completely. And I everything you said kind of sounds like it's awesome, and I agree with. I just don't know how to go down this rabbit hole. It just seems like, yeah, I agree, I agree, I agree. But I feel like I have a lot to learn. But I do want to ask you about AI though. So. Because it seems like there's this confluence and there's sort of this synergy of different things coming together. And I like how you mentioned that there could be this second techno science revolution. And I kind of get what you're saying about Bitcoin as immutable money and how you can really build and scale on that and with no leakage, right? And you go on to write, Bitcoin introduces immutability to measure and account productivity gains due to abundance of energy and intelligence from advances in nuclear engineering and AI. Bitcoin also lets the accelerationist decouple from the state who views techno-capital progress as a threat. And it's interesting because when I hear the word acceleration or accelerationism within the Bitcoin context, I think about sort of the destruction of the current system or the acceleration of Bitcoin adoption. I think this is a little bit different and much more energy driven. But so how does AI play into this and to sort of play into this sort of second renaissance?
Yeah, so I think we are, I think, learning a lot about AI as we keep on developing. Literally every week, every month, as new models come online, I think we are learning new things about AI. For the most part, I actually believe that AI is an underhyped technology. Like, and a lot of people will call me, all sorts of like things for saying this because everyone hears about AI these days. All the Magnificent Seven stocks are all rallying because of AI hype and things like that. And even in spite of those these things, I do think that AI is actually an underhyped technology. We, for the most part, don't really understand what kind of capabilities AI will have over the next 2, 3, 5, 10 years. And to that extent, I think we are really at a cusp of this, techno-scientific revolution where, artificial intelligence and intelligence in general will play a very significant role in uplifting productivity and uplifting human civilization to do things that are really more important to us. And think of humans as evolving into a more sort of, aristocratic class of in a sense where AI will be subservient to us in doing almost everything that we need, while we end up spending all of our time into doing things that are, good for our mind, body, soul, for our own spirituality, for our own creativity, and literally like end up like sort of, eradicating poverty, eradicating various sorts of, issues that we face in human civilization across the globe, and really empower us to, on this like deflationary path that has always been kind of promised, but has, and that's where I think the whole idea about state regulations and, central bank fueled inflation comes into play, where whatever technological acceleration that has happened over the last 20, 30 years, which has mostly been in the information sector, or the information technology domain, will now kind of expand into like more real world hardware oriented things. So I think we'll see a manufacturing renaissance, we'll see an energy renaissance, we will see all sorts of new things that are coming online. And all of this will have a strong AI overlay because AI and information renaissance is not stopping. We are literally at the very, very beginning of this. I mean, if you remember, like, ChatGPT has only been out for like whatever, like 12 or 14 months. And we already see like public company CEOs, coming on these, quarterly calls and saying that, AI is already helping us boost our productivity. AI is already helping us do better customer service and things like that. And we are literally like 1 year into this. So I think AI has a really important role to play. So in that sense, I'm definitely very excited about where we are headed over the next several years. And I firmly believe that we are underhyping this technology and not overhyping this technology, actually.
I probably think in terms of Bitcoin is probably underhyped as well, and I wonder if we're headed towards a very abrupt decoupling. But I want to get into building in Bitcoin and Theia, and what exactly was the problem you were looking to solve, and why not single sig? Why multi-sig? Maybe we'll start there. Why do you think multi-sig is definitely the way to go?
Yeah, so I think single sig over, custodial exchanges, and then multi sig over single sig. I mean, that's how I sort of technically put it. Single sig is a good entry point into taking care of your coins and managing the security of your coins. The problem with single sig is by definition it's a single point of failure, right? So if you end up losing your hardware device, or if your seed phrase gets stolen or lost, or if your hardware device is corrupted, you basically toast. And that's no good. If you're thinking of holding your coins for the long term, if you're thinking of holding your coins for your family, for your kids, for your future generations, single sig is ideally not the best way to go about it. I would again say single sig is certainly like orders of magnitude better than keeping your coins on exchanges. But the real gold standard of self-custody is multi-sig. And we know this because many, after several cycles and several attempts at improving custody standards, many OGs and many sort of, old grade institutional adopters of Bitcoin, for the most part, hold their coins on multi-sig. The problem has been that most of these multi-sig software are not really accessible to plebs and whole coiners and as I say, like more modest stackers of Bitcoin. And that was the real problem we were trying to solve. That, okay, how do we make this technology easier and better for people who are not trying to like, you know, hold like 1,000 coins or 100 coins? And that's a problem we were trying to solve. There is a lot of like, you know, argument of, okay, like, you know, is on-chain the real way of scaling? Honestly, I don't know. I do think that people will continue to, at least like the early adopters of Bitcoin, and I call everyone before 2023 as early adopters of Bitcoin, will continue to hold their coins on chain, and they do need a way to manage their security and manage the custody of these coins for multiple generations. And to that extent, multisig is the real sort of, you know, way of bringing more resilience to your stack. You have multiple keys that you can distribute geographically and have physical copies of your seed phrases in multiple places. And then, you know, introduce all sorts of like newer things like time locks, and, you know, introduce a trusted family member as a shared account owner and things like that. All of these things are not really possible on single sig, while it is certainly possible on multisig. And you yourself said that, you know, you guys at Bitcoin Advisor, you know, have this idea of collaborative custody, where typically one of the keys is held by you as a financial advisor, as a fiduciary to your clients. This is only possible on a multisig setup. It's not really possible on a single sig setup. And this realization sort of is not new. So in many sense, multisig is not a new technology. It's been around for many, many years. It's just that nobody has really solved a platform or a paradigm to make this more accessible to like regular Bitcoiners and plebs and whole coiners, essentially.
Sure. Yeah. So can you maybe describe like how Thea goes about making it more accessible than maybe some of the, you know, the older or more legacy offerings in multisig? I love it. One of the things I really like about it is how it's been maybe, it's very family friendly. And I liked it how it was able, I was introduced my wife to multisig just through an app. And just an email and a download.
Right. So this, again, there is this idea that, you know, mobile phones are not really going away anytime soon. We know that mobile phones act as a very strong on-ramp for many new things. And that could be the case for multisig self-custody as well, as long as you're able to like create a framework that, you know, in which you can use your mobile phone as one of your signing device. Now, the first iteration of the app that we launched, it was primarily launched for these people who wanted to like have a mobile friendly or mobile first multisig custodial vaults, where in the two of three multisig vaults that they have with us, the two keys that they control, both of them lie on two separate, you know, phone devices that they control or their family members control. So, you know, it becomes really, really easy for people to like manage the custody, as long as the key and the phone remains in their possession and in their security. Now someone asked, okay, like what happens if the phone is stolen or a phone is lost? The idea is that nothing really happens because there are multiple layers of security built into the phone as well. We primarily only support like iOS right now. And the reason why we only support iOS is because, you know, we're able to leverage the secure enclave and the hardware sort of chip on iPhone devices that allows us to generate the key and store it locally on your device, which is protected then by a biometrics, as well as a copy of that, you know, key is, you know, stored on your iCloud in an encrypted fashion. So there are these multiple levels of security that we kind of like brought into place using a mobile phone. And then, you know, on top of that, we also support, you know, hardware devices like Trezor, Cold Card, Ledger, and then, you know, upcoming foundation devices and Blockstream Jade and several others that are popular in the Bitcoin community. So we don't really want to like have a strong recommendation that you can only do your multisig in a certain way. What we're trying to bring is modularity. And what modularity means is that the two keys that you control, they can be controlled on any two devices of your choice. If you want to like control your two keys on two separate iPhones, that's your decision, and that's if that's a good enough setup for you, that's a way to go. If you want to like have one iPhone and one hardware device, that's also possible with Thea. If you want to do two hardware, so let's say if both your keys you control needs to be on hardware devices, that's absolutely possible as well. The third key typically stays with us as a recovery key, as a recovery partner. You could also like modularize that. You can say that, okay, like you want this third key to be held by a financial advisor or someone else. We can also make that possible. So what we have been doing and introducing is introducing modularity to multisig from a very ground up level. And to that extent, giving the sovereignty and control back to the users and say that, okay, you decide what's the best setup for the three keys that you own. If you want us to hold one of your keys and act as a recovery partner, we are more than happy to do that. We are more than capable to do that. But at the same time, the decision is on you in terms of how you want to like manage your keys. And the management of your keys can go all the way from a mobile friendly setup to a completely hardware cold setup and everything in between, right? So that's a really long and a complicated way of sort of explaining all the various combinations possible of different keys on Theia.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's a lot more permutations and combinations and modularity options here. I am very familiar with the Onchained and the Casa setups. Theia is a little bit newer to me, so I'm using the two phones, but obviously you could use two hardware devices, and there's all different, I would think.
So yeah, I would say that Casa and Unchained are again like great companies that we firmly respect. And I think what we have done is essentially support the models that they support as well, in the sense that okay, so Casa has this idea of doing two of three multi-sig with one mobile device and one hardware device. That is totally possible with Theia. And then on the other hand, Unchained has a model of two hardware devices and no mobile device, and that's totally possible on Theia as well. Along with the fact that we can also do two mobile devices on Theia, so right, so we have mobile, we have mobile hardware, and then we have hardware. All three combinations are possible, and the next step is that even a third recovery key can be held by someone else. It doesn't have to be just Theia. So you could decide that you want some other institutional partner to hold this key, you want your financial advisor to hold this key, and so on and so forth. So there is modularity on all three keys, and the form factor can be a mobile device or a hardware device of your choice. So it's basically about like giving the control fully back to the user instead of restricting them to just a hardware plus hardware combination or just a mobile plus hardware combination that we have seen in first iteration of services like multisig.
Awesome. So, and forgive me if these questions are a little like elementary, but and I would think that if you're on two mobiles and you have two mobiles in the house, that's sort of like more of a warmer wallet, and because you maybe and then you could have your you could have mobile and you could have a hardware device in the house, or you could have that at a bank, or you could have two hardware devices. Now, in the case of, with the mobiles, does Thea have access to the mobile keys in terms of could they turn those keys?
We cannot turn those keys at rest. So when you are not really signing any transaction, we have absolutely no way of like accessing those keys. If you are concerned about we being potentially exposed to those keys when you're signing a transaction, then you want to introduce hardware wallets into the mix. And as soon as you involve hardware wallets, there is no way for us to like access those keys. You're right to sort of call a mobile multisig as a more warmer form of multisig, but the idea behind that was to really introduce the concept of multisig to new folks and folks who are not
That's what I
necessarily
love
very
about
used
it.
to
Yeah.
using multisig. Yes, so we want to like make sure that if you don't, so a hardware combination is a completely like trust minimized combination where you literally like don't need to trust Theia at all, as long as you trust say Ledger and Cold Card and other like Bitcoin wallets, Trezor, and so on and so forth. And on the other hand, if you're using a mobile combination, you are placing small amount of trust on Theia, but it's only supposed to anyways be an introductory multisig wallet. It's not really a wallet where we expect users to like store like material configuration or material portion of their Bitcoin stack onto that. That's more of a starter wallet, and we expect to make this free and open source over time and globally available, so that this can be used as a good way for people to like on ramp onto multisig. And as soon as they hit a certain threshold of overall Bitcoin holdings, we strongly advise them to introduce a hardware wallet into the mix.
Awesome. And then with the hardware wallets, Are those with seed phrases and or seedless, or is it one or the other?
So you can make the entire experience of holding keys with Theia seedless, but it's not necessarily a thing that we enforce top down. So it's up to you. If you want to keep, seed copies of your hardware wallet, we more than welcome you to do so. But on the other hand, there is a possibility of having a seedless custody experience with Theia. And that's really, this is where I think education becomes very, very important, and that's why we are really focused on doing a lot of like strong education and product marketing around what we are building, where people have, right concerns about not wanting to keep their seed phrase or, using a mobile phone as a key. But using mobile phone as a key in your multisig setup as an introductory, wallet, I think is totally fine, as long as you're taking care of, the health check of the key on a regular basis and making sure that, the two phones that you, let's say, have different iClouds and different, password to those iClouds. So let's say if you and your wife have the same password to your iCloud account, I would say then that becomes security risk, and you should not ideally should not be doing that. If you're using a seed, hardware wallet, it's up to you if you want to like store the seed phrase or not. If you're comfortable with storing a seed phrase, I think you should certainly do that. That's what I do personally. I have, seed phrase backups of all my hardware devices, and I have figured out a mechanism over the years to keep them safe and secure. But at the same time, it can be a seedless experience as long as you feel comfortable with that.
Yeah, I was just curious. I probably more in favor of a seed experience, but I mean, I think there are some great cases for seedless. I was just curious on that one. And, I think there's just so many ways you can use Theia, and it's great how user-friendly it is. I think one of the easiest ways to use it is for newer people to kind of use it as that sort of that warm or sort of that spending wallet. And just get used to transactions and the idea of multi-sig, but there's obviously ways you can build this to be, a fortress of steel. So,
So you brought an interesting point. I mean, we are currently, as we speak, thinking about how do we bring single sig capabilities as well to the Theia wallet. Ideally, the single sig would, at least in my conception, would be a Lightning wallet than an on-chain wallet. But there is a case to be made that there should also be a single sig on-chain wallet onto Theia. But we'll certainly sort of, we are excited about like introducing Lightning capabilities to Theia in a single sig format by before the end of this year. Now, the whole idea of non-custodial versus custodial Lightning wallet and how do we go about architecting those two different scenarios is something that we need to like figure out. But we certainly, want to have a single sig experience as well on the Theia wallet. But it's not, we're not going to advise you to keep more than, say, 3 to 5% of your overall Bitcoin funds into a single sig wallet on any mobile device, for that matter.
right. And then al along these lines, like, who do you think of as the target audience? I mean, obviously all Bitcoiners, but how do you think about your target audience?
I would say two major sort of categories of users that we end up serving right now, and we see a very strong interest from people who are even today buying Bitcoin on exchanges. So you can argue that some of the newer demand, some of the more sort of richer households have migrated to like ETFs for buying their Bitcoin. But folks who are still sort of using different exchanges and Bitcoin on ramps to stack their Bitcoin, but have no real good way of taking self custody, and hence they are stuck with online exchanges and exchange custodians to take care of their keys. That's our primary audience. So anyone who is, using a variety of different Bitcoin on-ramps and they don't feel comfortable keeping their coins onto those exchanges, they are the most sort of welcome set of users to use Theia. And the second category of users who end up using Theia is these single sig hardware wallet owners who want to actually build resilience onto their, into their custody mix. So as obviously as Bitcoin price is exploding, people are, people of all shades, by the way, not just Bitcoiners, but even, believe it or not, like even people from the crypto community have reached out to us saying that, hey, like, we hold 30% of our overall crypto holdings in Bitcoin, and that has now become like 60%, and we want to like manage this better. How do we do this? And then we have the other extreme where, sort of, hardcore Bitcoiners who have 100% of their wealth, or at least large portions of their wealth in Bitcoin, and they're using single sig hardware devices. They want to have more resilience, maybe have a shared custody with their family, maybe want to set up an inheritance, a soft inheritance mechanisms if they are not no longer around. In that case, that becomes a very, very valuable Thea becomes a very valuable service to them as well. So just to summarize, first set of users is folks who are still stacking their Bitcoin on exchanges and different on-ramps. And then second set of users would be folks who are using single sig hardware devices for custodying their Bitcoin. So they can just use the same hardware device and bring it to the Thea mix and use their phone or some other additional hardware device as a way to do multi-sig with Thea.
Yeah, I mean, I find that there's this typical Bitcoiner counterparty risk dilemma and sort of evolution. So you go from like, I want to be a real Bitcoiner and I don't want to have any counterparty risk from any third party. So you get your sats off the exchange and then you realize that you're your own counterparty risk now, or you're your single point of failure to yourself. And you don't want to lose your own Bitcoin and you don't want to screw it up for yourself. And then whether through, evolution of thought or just evolution of life, you're like, now I don't want to be the counterparty risk to my family. And I might know what I need to do to secure this and how to get this in the event of an emergency, but what happens if something to me? So you go from like, I don't want the third party to be the risk, to I don't want to be the risk to myself, to I don't want to be the risk to others. And that's why you go through this sort of natural evolution in solutions, which is the exchange to the single sig to the multi-sig to how do I make sure this multi-sig is secured for me and generations to come. And that just seems
Absolutely, and
natural.
that's the right way to think about it. The first and foremost thing to do is to buy Bitcoin and exit the fiat system. You buy Bitcoin using exchanges and on-ramps. Then you think about self-custody, and then once you do self-custody, you realize, okay, I'm my own single point of failure, so I want to have more resilience into my Bitcoin custody. And that's when you land onto multi-sig, and that's exactly what we are trying to solve for and serve here, where long-term Bitcoiners who are still on exchanges or who are still using single sig hardware devices, we help them do better custody and better management of their coins with a more user, with a more intuitively designed software experience with Thea.
Right. And so it's like, your multi-sig solution is sort of like, even if you build it all yourself, open source, these are your teammates. And so building in Bitcoin, how did you think about building your team, and putting together the team for Thea?
I've been very fortunate to have co-founded this company with two of my other friends who I've known from past lives, Vikas and Sriram. Both of them have their own unique journeys into Bitcoin. So Vikas has been a very successful entrepreneur in his first part of his career, where he built a $1 billion technology logistics company before he got into Bitcoin. And Sriram, he's been, and sort of engineering veteran in Silicon Valley. Started his career with Google, and then went on to working at Robinhood and several other sort of Bitcoin and crypto aligned companies over the last few years. And he has his own inclinations towards why he wanted to go back to Bitcoin in the same 2022, 2023 timeframe. So we all kind of got together, and we all had interesting sort of backgrounds and different skill sets, and three of us got together to start this company. And since then, we've been we went to Y Combinator, we raised our seed round. We have some of the most sort of top name investors from Silicon Valley who backed this Bitcoin only vision, and that's an interesting story as well about how we are actually perhaps the only Bitcoin-only company in YC's current portfolio. And to that extent, a fairly unique value proposition and a fairly unique company in the broader Silicon Valley ecosystem. And over the last few months, we've added several talented folks to our team. So we have expanded our engineering team, we expanded our design team, And then now I'm working with many great people from some of the people on Bitcoin Twitter on marketing and education. So we have people like Joe Consorti, and Zach Ignard. Both of them do great sort of education and research content at Thea.
Well, nice. Now, I want to hear a little bit more about YC and raising money as a Bitcoin-only company. What was the YC experience like? What does it offer beside, what kind of does that kind of come with maybe?
Yeah, so I think basically applying to Y Combinator in December of 2022. So this is 1 month after the FTX collapse. The crypto market had completely died down by then. Bitcoin was trading something like $16,000-$17,000 a coin, and it felt like there is no investor interest in this space. Given that both Vikas, I, and Sriram have had like fairly sort of successful technology career before this, a lot of people. Our colleagues, our well-wishers were asking us, are you guys insane to be starting up in Bitcoin right now? And we were like, yeah, this is it. Like, this is our calling. We know that this thing, like FTX collapse or like whatever happened in 2022 does not really matter to Bitcoin in the long run. And in fact, it's the right time to be building in a bear market. And so we applied to Y Combinator with a very, very simple Bitcoin-only thesis. And we got accepted like on sort of in li literally sort of in less than we applied, we got an interview call next week, and the same day we got a result back saying that we are in. And for the most part, like, we were actually like super thankful to the whole YC experience. I don't think they got us in because we were a Bitcoin company per se. They got us in because we have experience building other software companies and technology companies in the past. But they could see that, okay, these guys with a tremendous amount of experience in building software and technology companies in the past are actually coming up with a very mature sort of single narrow-minded pitch around Bitcoin instead of going on to like DeFi and yields and NFTs and marketplaces and things like that. I think they saw that we had a very clear intent and design behind what we were doing. I think that's what they liked. And then once we were in YC, I think the experience was very significant, I would say. Given it was second time starting up for two out of three of the three co-founders, we weren't like very sure if Y Combinator is going to be like super useful, but boy, we were so wrong about it. I think Y Combinator's community and culture had a tremendous sort of it was tremendously beneficial to us, and it definitely helped us put our name out there and raise money from like more traditional venture capital investors in Silicon Valley who don't necessarily sort of, let's say, invest in Bitcoin only companies. So yeah, I think it was a strong experience for us. I would highly recommend sort of considering applying to YC for like first time founders, especially if any of your listeners is planning to like start up either in the Bitcoin space or even in the non-Bitcoin broader technology software space. If you are sort of young and early and have a clear pitch, I would highly recommend sort of going through a YC experience because that kind of like stays with you for a very, very long time. And yeah, like I think they open up a lot of like doors for you in the long run. So we are definitely very grateful to the whole YC experience. It was a little funny in the sense that most people in YC did not really understand Bitcoin. And when I say most of the YC, I mean most of the founders in our batch did not really understand Bitcoin that well. And then over time, I think now that we entered the YC batch with 18,000 per coin, and we are kind of like now at 65,000 per coin, I think it's a whole different ball game, and I think they see us in a very different light. And many founders from the YC network now reach out to us saying that, hey, we want to like do our treasury, our corporate treasury in Bitcoin. Can you guys help us? And we are like, hell yeah. I mean, by the way, like one thing which we don't necessarily talk about a whole lot is that Thea is actually used, it Thea is actually perfect for like small teams and small startups to like custody their own Bitcoin because the multisig can be divided between like different founders, and they can basically control their keys for forever essentially, and not really have to worry about relying on custodians and exchanges and things like that. So Overall, I would say a YC was a tremendously beneficial experience, and I feel that over time we will be giving back a lot to the YC community as well, in terms of helping some of these, more younger folks who are not necessarily sort of inclined towards thinking about money and Bitcoin and things like that, and really sort of bringing them to Bitcoin over time.
Well, I want to ask you, do you, miss building in the bear market? And I ask this in the sense that, like, has Bitcoin ever been in a bear market? I mean, going from zero to 69,000 and back down to whatever and back up. I mean, that sounds pretty bullish. But, and also, I think, before, we might have touched all-time high today, but like, until we really break through, I still think of us a little bit still in a bear market, even though the last year has obviously been a bull market in that time frame. But let's say we're out of the bear market. Do you miss building in a bear market? Is it better to get the phone calls from the other VCs and founders and startups with the interest, or do you miss just building with your head down?
No, I think starting your company in the bear market was the best decision we could ever take. So I think we spent most of our 2023 literally like building without really thinking about how do we take this thing and publicize this, right? So I think 2023 was a very interesting year where we were basically like we had bottomed out in end of 2022, and then 2023 at least Bitcoin has believed that okay, like we are now again gonna see an upswing, but for the most part it was we were in a bear market territory. And it literally like helped us not have any major distractions, and also having like relatively like different or well-adjusted expectations from some of the investors who are not necessarily traditional Bitcoin investors in our case, right? So I think 2023 was a very interesting year. We do like the energy of a bull market now. I think it's just better for growth. You are right. If you're thinking about just writing code and being building stuff and designing stuff, bear markets are better. But now that we have a working product, now that we are live in US and Australia, and we are going to go live in Europe in coming weeks, we definitely like the bull market energy. We definitely think that we have built one of the best products out there in terms of the Bitcoin industry. And we will continue to serve this industry and the community with many more features and many more like products that will help them take care of their coins and custody in the long run. So there are many opportunities in front of us. We started with serving consumers and customers, but now we see like growing interest from like small businesses and other like businesses to act as a key agent, to act as a multi-institutional custody partner, and so on and so forth. So we are really excited about partnering with some other many other great companies building in the Bitcoin space. And this is a great time. And I wish everyone starts their company in a bear market. And then by the time they are ready to go to market, bull markets are nice for growth. So.
Yeah. On March 1st, BitPain tweeted, "The real mind fuck is this. Unless you're going to found a billion-dollar company, unlikely. There is nothing you will do in your entire financial life that will matter more than beginning to save in Bitcoin as early as possible." And you wrote back, "What if you're trying to found a billion-dollar company while your entire life, including personal finances, is nothing but long Bitcoin? How bullish is that, Mr. BitPain?" I want to ask you, maybe in line with that, as a technologist, which I love that word. I was talking about Burnett about that recently, and I haven't really thought about sort of that word in our society recently. But as a technologist, an entrepreneur, a CEO, and an investor, what do you think of Coinbase and their technical issues every time there's a bull market?
In terms of what I think about Coinbase, I think I have multiple views about Coinbase. I don't think I have a very simple like cookie cutter one-liner response to what Coinbase stands for. I think in many regards, Coinbase does not really stand for the values that, let's say, at least Coinbase today does not necessarily stand for the values that Bitcoin stands for. But in many regards, Coinbase has done its part in terms of like making Bitcoin more accessible to people, especially to Americans. We can agree or disagree about the whole the whole shitcoin trading arm that they have, and probably they make most of their money through trading of altcoins and other sort of useless tokens. But I think they've played some role in terms of bringing Bitcoin to the masses. And I think to that extent, I'm kind of like in a very confused state about how to think philosophically about Bitcoin. What we've been seeing in the last 1 week, I think today was the third time when the balances went zero on Coinbase. And it's very unfortunate where, you know, I definitely understand that, you know, Coinbase is operating at a very different scale. I'm like a nobody in terms of our scale versus Coinbase scale. They're like orders and orders of magnitude bigger than us. So I want to be like, you know, I want to caveat by saying that I'm extremely humble about where we stand and the kind of customers that we serve versus what Coinbase is doing. But at the same time, time has been on their side. I mean, they have been around since 2012, 2013. They have seen multiple bull cycles. They have seen multiple surge in network traffic in terms of, you know, new buying and things like that. And when this happens on days when Bitcoin is hitting all-time high and then crashing back $7,000, $8,000, and people are kind of like feeling confused about where did their balance go, where their coins go. I think Coinbase can do better, and I would have expected them to be doing like better scaling of their infrastructure during the bear market time in anticipation of a bull market, right? So as a long-term sort of kind of outside admirer of what they've been trying to achieve from a technology and startups point of view, I'm kind of disappointed with what happened. Having said that, you know, these kinds of things actually end up helping Theia and make RK stronger about like taking control of their own keys and taking control of their own coins. So, I'm kind of in a mixed mind, right? So we obviously don't want anyone who is holding their coins on Coinbase to like lose their coins. Absolutely not. That would be the most horrible thing to happen. But at the same time, I think people need to realize that you don't want to trust custodians, even somewhat trusted parties like Coinbase, who have been around for the past 10 years. And to their credit, there's never been like a major rug pull or any kind of like, you know, failure at Coinbase's end in terms of them losing coins or you know, things like that. But you definitely don't want to like store your money on Coinbase for too long. You definitely want to take self-custody and ideally multisig. So I'm humbled to know that we don't operate at the same scale, but at the same time, as an outside observer of this space, I'm disappointed that they could not build more stronger systems and infrastructure during the bear market. So
I mean, I got mixed feelings with Coinbase. Most of them are shitty feelings. I mean, I agree with you that like when I was first looking to buy some sats, I wanted to buy it from the most reputable place in America, and that seemed to be Coinbase. And I went to Coinbase, and you know, they had other coins there positioned. So that made me really see these things as similar, like-kinded assets. Hearing Brian Armstrong speak, you know, in 2016, 2017, 2018, he understood to me what Bitcoin is, and it just seems odd that he still wants to be in the business of trading all these other things, to me, based on things he said back then. And it just seems like too big of a coincidence that they haven't hammered out all these issues around this simple act of they are literally a buy and sell company of Bitcoin. And every time the buying gets heated, they break down. It's like the one thing they do. You know, I just got
they're a trading marketplace. Yeah, I mean they are a trading marketplace. We can you know. As Bitcoiners, we have our own views on if that is good or not, bad for society. But
he's free to do what he wants.
Exactly, he's free to do what he wants. But at the same time, just as you know, as someone who watches this space of like technology startups and technology companies in general, I'm disappointed. Forget the whole Bitcoin or crypto angle, or Bitcoin versus crypto angle. Like as an observer of this space, I feel that they could have done better in terms of managing.
I think they all should have went to jail over Litecoin. Charlie Lee, director of what, engineering there, or the CTO, and I think they all could have been put in jail easily. An honest prosecutor looked at that and had a system he could work with, an honest system that dished out justice. Regardless of the other good things they might have done, I thought that was insider trading, really at a very low threshold. But you know, considering your background, considering what you're doing in Bitcoin, like, how do you think we could attract more top talent to the Bitcoin space?
I think education remains key, and at some level, what you need to like do is help people understand. I think there are several different ways in which you can like go about doing this. One of the things that I've recently started out doing, especially like some of colleagues or people around here in Silicon Valley and broader in California with more sort of progressive or left-leaning political bias. They are very quick to like dismiss capitalism for saying that capitalism is bad. We are in this sort of late stage capitalistic cycle. And what I the way I kind of like go about talking to them is that actually capitalism is not bad. What is problematic is broken money and the broken money that kind of powers this late stage capitalism. Capitalism is single greatest force in terms of driving human progress and human civilization forward. What is really driving us back and decelerating us is the brokenness of money. And that can be a good starting point in terms of helping them realize that, okay, maybe like money has a much more important role to play than just being a unit to like define your wealth or just being a way to like buy things. And I think it's a lot about like education and helping them, direct to the right sources. I mean, there is so much great literature that collectively the Bitcoin community and some of the great Bitcoin authors have written over the years. And honestly, I mean, there is literature that people from all different backgrounds and political biases can interact with and really come to a firm grounding understanding that, okay, like Bitcoin is not here to like just enrich, sort of some like top wealthy people. Bitcoin is here as an equitable form of money, and it's truly a global form of money that everyone from the top billionaire to some of the most poorest people in the world can use it. And they can use it in the same exact same manner. I think that really makes makes a ton of sense. And I think I think like I always say this, accelerating Bitcoin or accelerating Bitcoin's adoption is not something that we as a community can like we can obviously play our part, but for the most part, I think as people see the perils and destruction that this late stage broken money or the late stage broken sort of fiat monetary standard brings to human society and human civilization, I think they will kind of like good money drives out bad money logic. And I think once people start seeing that, people naturally want to work in Bitcoin. So I don't have like a very specific strategy in terms of like attracting talent. We definitely want to like only work with people who are open-minded about being in Bitcoin and understanding Bitcoin. So we don't expect people to be like a Bitcoin maximalist or to understand Austrian theory before joining Theia. But we at least check if they are open-minded about these ideas and they're open-minded about being challenged of their conception of fiat money before they interview with us or like they end up joining us. And yeah, I mean it's a relatively slow process. I mean, we can't expect overnight the best engineers and the best designers and the best product managers in the world to like start working in Bitcoin. But as we see more Bitcoin-only companies succeed and create value, there will be more talent who is attracted towards this new monetary domain.
Yeah. Well, speaking of talent, with Satoshi's recent emails that were released and anything I've come across, and I don't think I've ever really thought about this before, but I wonder what Satoshi's setup was, for security and how it may or may not have evolved, whether Satoshi's alive or not, whether, Satoshi passed away, and I wonder what the setup was like then versus maybe if Satoshi's alive, how Satoshi has looked at security since the beginning of Bitcoin. I mean, just mining has evolved so much since the beginning of Bitcoin and even hardware, and the splitting out of those two functions. Security, and or even someone like, and I hate to bring this up, but even just how Finney thought about security. And I don't want to speculate on, anything with but like, or just any of the OGs, how they've kind of looked at security over time, just even philosophically, and how their own setups have evolved.
Yeah, so I think we did a piece on history of like Bitcoin sort of wallets. I think a while ago, and I can share that with your audience after this as show notes. But I think, like, certainly Bitcoin's sort of security in terms of custody itself has evolved certainly like tremendously since 2011. And I'm not the most of technically well-versed person to speak about this with authority, but we have seen several generations of like different protocols and different mechanisms that have emerged. But what one thing has been common since 2012, 2013 has been that for the most part, like multisig is considered like the gold standard of custody, where if you are serious about your long-term custody of your coins, you certainly want to like consider doing multisig. And it kind of makes sense, right? It is naturally more resilient. It is naturally you can naturally make it more like geo-distributed, so you can have your keys in different locations in different places. It takes out all sorts of like natural risk. It takes out all sorts of like theft risk and things like that. Even though the exact setup or the exact protocol that the way addresses are generated and the way sort of transactions are signed, that has kind of evolved over this last several years as the Bitcoin sort of software has also evolved. But the basic principles on how to do custody has, in my opinion, has not really changed too much since 2012, 2013. In terms of speculating what Satoshi might have done for their keys, I think I have almost like no idea on how to like think about that. It is quite likely that they intentionally destructed the key of their original wallet. It is quite likely that is still in possession of some human or some human agency. It's hard to know, but I think like I do sort of speculate that Satoshi definitely understood the importance of like security like much more than anyone else in that sort of cypherpunk era. And in many ways, Bitcoin was always kind of designed such that self-sovereignty and self-dependence was one of the key sort of design philosophical design principles behind thinking of this system. So what he, she, or they might have done in terms of their own keys and wallet, I have no idea, and I don't know if I'm in the right place to even speculate what that might be.
Yeah, imagine Satoshi was so overwhelmed writing code and fixing bugs and running around shooting off emails and answering message boards that they were just losing paper wallets everywhere. And just like, I can't even keep up with all this
Right.
Bitcoin.
Absolutely. That's what I would like to believe, that the Satoshi wallet is beyond recoverable now. That would be the best thing that can happen. But honestly, like even if like let's take the most extreme hypothetical where somehow it gets leaked that someone like a CIA is in possession of Satoshi's wallet, I think it still does not really change anything about Bitcoin today. I mean, at best, U.S. government will have access to 1 million coins, which is pretty hefty. But that doesn't change the protocol. That doesn't change the network. That doesn't change a single thing about Bitcoin. And that's truly what Satoshi sort of gifted us, right? That this thing is beyond some single person. This is an idea. This is a revolution. And yeah, it's probably one of the most important moments in human history.
Yeah, I have a sort of vivid fantasy of Satoshi burning the keys to these wallets as they're being created, knowing they're never going to be used
Right.
intentionally and never even looking to store them.
That
My final
would be the
question.
most ideal outcome. Yeah.
My final question to you would be, if you could orange pill anyone in the world, who would it be and why?
Okay, that's a tough one. I do believe that and I do believe that people who have sort of significant or people who have significant political influence would so, someone with significant political influence would be my choice. And now it depends on which geography and which kind of person you want to choose. But I would say, while Bitcoin so far has been a bottoms-up adoption, I think the next leg of Bitcoin would be driven by countries and nation states who realize that they can't really defeat Bitcoin, and the best way for them is to actually back their own sovereign sort of currency, their fiat money, with a hard standard like Bitcoin. So I would say that would be my sort of personal, yeah, that would be I wouldn't like name anyone just yet, but my my personal sort of inclination would be to orange pill someone who wields like significant political influence, and hopefully they can bring Bitcoin into their sort of political platform and really transform the country, nation state, region, whatever they control.
Yeah, sounds like El Salvador and Bukele, but I hear you. It's a
Exactly. So, yeah, basically El Salvador and Bukele is a case study, and hopefully like many young entrepreneurial politicians and people with like genuine desire to like do good for the world are looking at that case study, and hopefully they'll bring Bitcoin to their community.
Yeah, I can see that. Smith, this has been so dope. I'll leave it to you to let people know where they can find you because you've been blowing it up and torching it on Twitter with fire tweets and content, and let people know where they could find Thea. I promote it, but let us know where we can find Thea and his services.
Absolutely. So I'm posting on Twitter at Smeet, my first name underscore Bhatt, my last name. So it's SMEET underscore BHATT. Find me there. DM me with any questions about Bitcoin, self-custody, Theia, or anything in general about technology and startups. You can find Theia also on Twitter with at the handle at the rate Theia Bitcoin. If you are in the US or Australia and want to like take self-custody of your coins, if you want to like introduce multisig to your long-term Bitcoin storage, please check us out. We have an app that is publicly listed and available on the iOS App Store, and we will be launching in several new geographies and going global this year, as well as bringing this app to Android phones as well. So yeah, thank you for hosting me, Cedric. It's been a fantastic conversation, and as I said, I've been a long-term listener of your show, and some of your past guests have had a significant influence on me as well.
Really appreciate that. This has been so great. Thank you so much, Smeet.
Thank you.
And that's what's up on this week with Smeet Bhatt on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. I hope that you found it as informative and enlightening as I did. Hit us up. We'd love to hear your feedback. And thank you for tuning in. If you want to buy sats and build your Bitcoin wealth, head over to River using my link to get up to $100 free in Bitcoin at partner.river.com/matrix. Get your sats off your exchange and secure them with the new standard in Bitcoin multi-sig security. And get 6 months free when you download the app at thea.us/Cedric. That's thea.us/CEDRIC. If you need help securing your Bitcoin, getting your estate planning and/or asset protection strategies in order so that you know your wife and kids will get your Bitcoin if anything happens to you, put some time on my calendar at thebitcoinadvisor.com/Cedric. That's thebitcoinadvisor.com/CEDRIC. Put that time on my calendar now before Bitcoin goes parabolic again and you can't sleep at night. Finally, please give the Bitcoin Matrix podcast a 5-star review wherever you dome your pods. That would really help me get the word out and help new listeners to find the show. Keep building, keep stacking, and always be laser focused out there. This is Cedric. Peace.